By the time Jack Grimaldi returned from Lima with Able Team on board, Captain Ellenbogen had downloaded the mission package from Stony Man and was ready for the mission briefing.
I'm glad that someone has finally sorted this shit out. We've been humping the pooch on this for far too long.
What about the new Coalition headquarters you guys were looking at?
Rafe, Gadgets fell in love with the architecture, so we decided to leave it for someone else to blow up.
Katz looked concerned. He knew that Brugnola had ordered them to pull out, but until they had proven this new information to be correct, they had to keep up their dialogue with the Coalition.
You did leave calling cards, though, didn't you?
Believe it. No one's going to be occupying that particular building for several days at least. Gadgets can do amazing things with a flashbang grenade, a roll of wire, and some black tape.
Before we get down to cases on this, I want to make sure that we all know what we're getting ourselves into. We're going into the heart of the Coalition territory to take on a force that we have no idea the size of. I can assure you, though, that there are a hell of a lot more of them than there are of us. We really don't have enough information to be doing this. Under normal circumstances, we wouldn't be. According to what that Indian kid told us, Stryker's been conducting some kind of harassment campaign against this camp. Now, if we had any way to get in communication with him, we could go in there, snatch him out. That would be it. Someone else could go in there and deal with Collins. But since that's not the case, we have no other choice but to go in there, find that camp, and take it out. If he's still alive, he'll hear the commotion and know that we finally arrived. If he doesn't hear us, once we've secured our backs, we'll go out in the woods and keep looking for him until we find him.
Selecting an image from his menu, Katz flashed a map onto his monitor.
Somewhere within this kilometer and a half circle is the camp we've been looking for. Now the recon runs picked up traces of buildings, what looks like fire pits, a well, a few storage dumps, that sort of thing. What we don't have is any indication of their bunkers or fortifications. This tells me that they have taken their defenses underground, which means that we're going to have to be very careful on our final approach. If we get mousetrapped by hidden bunkers out there, we're finished. The IR traces indicate that there is somewhere between 80 and 100 warm bodies down there. Now, we have no way of telling how many of them are trigger pullers and how many are water carriers. A rough estimate for this kind of operation in this part of the world would be 80% combatants, maybe a little less. So, that means that we will have, more or less, 8 dance partners apiece.
McCarter looked grim as he studied the map.
Going up against that many people on their own turf is going to be dicey at best. If we were making a raid, we could just kip in, shoot the place up, and kip back out again. I think I can open a gap for you, McCarter. With the GPS fire control system on that bird, I should be able to put my rounds dead onto the bunkers as soon as you can spot them for me. It's the spotting them in time that bothers me.
No one's asking you to commit suicide, David. If Jack can't open up a hole in that perimeter, we call off the assault.
And wait for what? The political situation isn't going to change until Collins is either killed or taken into custody. The 101st Airborne isn't going to drop from the sky and give us a hand with this, no matter what. As long as this remains a black op, we're the only chance Stryker has, so we have to deal with it.
Jack Grimaldi made a high-level recon of the first landing zone with the Black Hawk's forward-looking IR. David McCarter flew the co-pilot seat, manning the weapons and the fire control radar. When the LZ showed clear, he dropped lower and checked it again with the night vision equipment. When that showed no nasty surprises either, he brought the Blackhawk to a hover right above the treetops. Part of the concealment Collins had counted on when he moved his operation into this particular part of Peru was the density of the jungle. There were few, if any, clearings large enough to accommodate a helicopter. But that was exactly why the SAR Jungle Penetrator had been invented. The jungles in Southeast Asia had been just as bad. By crowding 3 men in a basket, Able Team could make it to the ground in one hoist. The 3 Able Team commandos rode the jungle penetrator through the trees to the ground. When the bottom of the basket touched the earth, they jumped out and formed a small defensive circle.
We're clear.
Roger.
Grimaldi pulled pitch and sent the chopper climbing, well out of sight and sound of the camp. Able Team moved out. On the other side of a 5-click circle centered on Collins's camp, Grimaldi again made a preliminary high recon before dropping down for a closer look with the FLIR gear.
We're go, but it's gonna be a basket job again.
We're on it.
McCarter called up from the SAR winch controls on the bulkhead by the door. As Grimaldi held the ship steady in a low hover, Hawkins, Enciso, and Manning stepped into the rescue basket for the first trip down. After strapping themselves in, Enciso gave a thumbs up, and McCarter swung out the basket's arm. As soon as the three men cleared the basket, McCarter winched it back up and stepped in with Katz and James.
We're go.
Going down.
We're clear.
And I'm out of here. Good luck.
Grimaldi hit the winch retraction controls at the same time that he pulled pitch to break off.
They're all on the ground.
Since Yakov, Katz, and Ellenbogen had decided to go with the raiding party, the tactical control of the mission had reverted to the farm.
I've got the keyhole satellite feed coming in, Chief. I've got the Black Hawk on screen, but nothing else is showing so far.
Since that was what had been expected, there was no problem. It was planned that the ground teams would be tracked by the GPS. Once the firefight broke out, though, the satellite's IR sensors would help fill in the picture. After clearing the LZ, Able Team moved out with Schwartz on point, and Lyons and Blancanales working the flanks. With only the three of them, they were keeping a tight formation. Coming in on the target from the other side, Calvin James was on point with TJ Hawkins pulling slack. With the density of the vegetation, Manning was on close-in drag. In the center of the formation, Katz, McCarter, and Enciso were maintaining their GPS location and transmitting the information to Grimaldi on a regular basis. The plan was to not get engaged going in. But if they stumbled into Collins's patrols or outposts, they would need the gunship on station ASAP. Jack Grimaldi had landed his chopper on the ground on a hilltop 12 miles away and was using it as a forward command post. With the radar keeping watch for him, Grimaldi was uploading the ground unit's positions directly into his fire control computer each time they took a GPS bearing. If they needed fire support tonight, having the updated GPS data would allow him to get on the target a few seconds faster. With his SATCOM link hot, he was also in instant communication with the farm. Pulling his thermos from the pouch behind his armored seat, he poured a cup of coffee and settled in to listen to the radio and wait. The ship's batteries were switched over to standby, which kept the navigation, fire control, and comm gear hot. It was going to be a long night. With the GPS to guide the Phoenix Force commandos, navigation through the jungle wasn't a problem. Though it was slow going, they were unerringly zeroed in on the enemy camp. The closer they came to it, the more cautious they were.
We just entered a cleared fire zone.
Hold there.
When Katz and the Briton reached James's position, they saw that the thinning of the jungle had been done artfully. Mostly it was the smaller trees and larger clumps of underbrush that had been cleared away, which left the large trees and the canopy intact.
We're in the fire lane here. We need to pull back.
As silently as they had moved in, the commandos moved back into the jungle 100 yards to wait out the dawn. Jack Grimaldi had long since drunk the last of the coffee in his thermos. Like most professional warriors, he was a dedicated caffeine junkie, and a late-night cup or three hadn't kept him from peacefully catnapping in his pilot seat. Even with the chopper's security system activated and keeping watch over him, his sleep had been that of a warrior. Wary. The slightest change in background noise would snap him instantly awake. The night had passed uneventfully, but the change in light as dawn approached also triggered his internal warning system. He was fully awake and ready to go when McCarter's voice came in over his earphones.
Flyboy, this is Rover. Time to get it in gear. Over.
Flyboy, roger. On the way. I'll check in when I'm on station. Over.
We'll be waiting. Out.
The pilot worked the fingers of his gloves tight before reaching out to flip the switches and punch the buttons to bring his two T-700 GE turbines to life. His eyes swept the digital readouts as the turbines spooled up. Though he still preferred analog instruments, he had to admit that the digital ones were easier to read. When a last glance showed that all the instruments were in the green, Grimaldi's left hand twisted the throttle and pulled up on the collective at the same time.
Rover, this is Flyboy. I'm airborne and en route. ETA 18 mics. Over.
Roger. Copy, Flyboy. We'll be waiting. Over.
Grimaldi hadn't been given the best circumstances in the world to fly fire support missions from a helicopter gunship, even from one as sophisticated as his Special Ops Black Hawk. The jungle below was much too dense for him to see targets on the ground. Conversely, though, none of the enemy on the ground could get a clear look at him either, which meant that no one would be firing Strela missiles at him, or even anti-aircraft rounds. The only thing that made his mission even possible was the GPS blind firing system. It allowed the gunship to deliver accurate fire to ground targets under zero visibility conditions. This was one time that Carl Lyons didn't mind being assigned to cover the back door. If this thing went down as Katz had planned, he and his two partners should have more than enough work to keep them busy. After moving into position the previous night, Schwartz had taken GPS readings and had radioed them to Grimaldi to load into his firing computer. The Special Ops issued GPS unit he used was calibrated to be accurate within 1.5 yards, or 5 feet. If they did have to call on Grimaldi's fire from the sky, 5.5 feet would be the new definition of what had previously been called danger close fire support. The old definition had been 100 yards. The six Phoenix Force warriors had broken down into 3 2-man fire teams for the initial assault. David McCarter was teamed with Katzen Ellenbogen, Raphael Enciso with Gary Manning, and Calvin James with TJ Hawkins. Going in individually would have made their force look larger, but against the kind of odds they had, it would have been almost suicidal to try to fight without someone watching their backs and flanks.
Rover, this is Flyboy. Anytime you're ready.
Roger, Flyboy. We're going in now. Out.
And we're ready on the back door. Out.
The six Phoenix Commandos rose from the damp jungle floor and started to move forward. They could smell wood smoke in the cool morning air as the Indian women in the camp started to prepare breakfast for the men. This was a slow time of day in a camp like this, when most of the inhabitants were more concerned with downing a couple of cups of coffee to start their day than anything else. Phoenix Force appeared out of the mist like jungle spirits. The first gorilla who spotted them blinked and looked again, trying to make sure it wasn't an apparition. Once the Stony Man warriors were inside the perimeter, more rebels appeared and the commandos opened up with a withering barrage. After the first long burst, they deployed into their fire teams, picked their next targets, and started to move in. It took a few seconds for the gorillas to recover from the surprise attack, but they returned fire, and the Phoenix Force warriors were forced to go into fire and maneuver mode. Not all of the Indian fighters stood their ground to fight. Some of them assumed the camouflage-painted commandos were allies of El Tigre and wanted no part of this fight. One by one, they laid their weapons down and turned away. The remaining cartel fighters in the camp were made of stronger stuff, but even they didn't want to die in a fight that wasn't really theirs. When they saw their Indian allies start to desert, some of them also started to look for a back door. The problem was that they'd been surrounded.
Get ready, Flyboy. Here they come.
Schwartz was handling the forward air controller duty and had his GPS transmitter at his side. The field glasses in his hand had a laser range-finding feature that gave him the near-exact range to anything he could see through them. All he had to do was take a reading of the range and bearing from his position and call it up to Grimaldi to input into his fire computer. The autocannon would then put the rounds exactly on the target. Grimaldi guided his helicopter into a left-hand banked turn and swung the gun turret to the port side of the ship. When the fire control computer told him it was in the right place in the sky, he squeezed the trigger. The chain gun chewed up the jungle like a giant chainsaw stuck in overdrive. With the tracking system of the fire control radar set on dispersed fire, the 12-round bursts made a slashing cut through the trees. As Grimaldi had expected, the HE rounds detonated in the trees, but most of the shrapnel from the exploding shells rained to the ground anyway.
Check fire!
Grimaldi's rain of death from the sky had done its job. The gorillas had been stopped in their tracks, and those who had been left on their feet dropped their guns and turned to flee. On the other side of the camp, Hawkins was doing the GPS readings for Phoenix Force. Since they were on the move instead of holding in static positions, he had to stay on top of it so someone didn't run into a hail of Grimaldi's 25-millimeter fire by mistake. Outnumbered as they were, the commandos were keeping on the move, never staying in one firing position for more than a minute or so. Move and shoot, move and shoot. It was the only way they could hope to stay alive. And with the constant changing of position, Hawkins was using his own location as a base point for fire control.
TJ, I need fire in front of me now. Azimuth 235, range 50.
Roger, Calvin. Copy 235, range 50. Keep your head down. I'll get it coming. Jack?
I copy. What's his position?
271, add 23.
Good copy.
In Boland's toxin-impaired state, his enhanced hearing picked up the sounds of battle from miles away. The sounds of gunfire weakened a part of his mind that had lain dormant since he had been poisoned. He suddenly remembered times when the sounds of battle had been all around him. The smell of cordite and the feel of a weapon bucking in his hands. He caught glimpses of the faces of men fighting beside him, and he knew that they were his comrades, his brothers. He also remembered that he had left a comrade in that camp, a man he had sworn to guard and protect. It didn't bother him that he couldn't recall the man's name, or that he only had the vaguest memory of his face. He knew, without knowing how, that the attack he could hear in the distance had something to do with the man he had left behind. He moved toward the sounds of battle at a loping run. Ramon Sabatas watched the battle with an experienced eye, and he didn't like what he was seeing. Whoever those Yankees were, and as few as they were too good at mass slaughter for his Indians to stand and fight. The gunship the Yankees had brought with them was also cutting the heart out of his fighters. He hadn't survived his long years as a mercenary soldier by fighting losing battles. This was one of those times that if he stayed, he was going to die. He didn't feel at all guilty about abandoning Collins to the Yankees. The Irishman had paid him well. But he had been an idealistic fool. He had come to Peru with grand plans and had been lucky at first in that the president was corrupt and his dreams of avarice were easily fed. Exactly what had gone wrong in Lima, he really didn't know. But it was apparent that the Americans hadn't been willing to allow the rebel coalition to exist very long. This came as no surprise to him. But the Irishman had been convinced that his nomination for the Peace Prize would protect him from the Yankees. He was being proven wrong. His decision made, Ramon Sabatas looked around to find his two Indian trackers. When the rebel commander spotted them, he used his field signals to call them to his location.
The Irishman is finished. I'm leaving.
The two Indians instantly nodded their assent. Sabatas was their boss, and their loyalty had always been to him, not to whomever he had signed on with. After reloading their ammo pouches with fresh magazines, the three men started to work their way to the east side of the perimeter. Keeping low, they had little trouble evading the last few hot spots of the battle. It was as if the Yankees had intentionally left a door open for anyone who didn't want to stay and die. Once past the perimeter, Sabatas and his two trackers made for the safety of the jungle as quickly as they could. They were in jungle camouflage battle dress instead of their tracking gear. But that wouldn't make them any less elusive in their home environment. They had a march of several days ahead of them before they would be completely safe. The fight was over. Phoenix Force and Able Team kept their weapons ready until it was clear that everyone was in accordance. With their backs well covered, Blancanales and Enciso stepped out.
Put your weapons down and your hands in the air. Do it!
On command, Grimaldi dropped down low. The Stony Man team quickly moved through the camp. Their weapons ready, and their eyes constantly searching for anyone who wanted to argue. The only rebels left in the camp were the dead, the wounded, and those who stood by their women and children with their weapons at their feet and their hands in the air. Other women silently tended to their wounded husbands and sons, carefully keeping their eyes averted from the men with guns in their hands. James broke out his medkit and started to tend the wounded. The first patient he saw to was Gadget Schwartz. Playing close-in forward air controller had earned him a slash across the forearm from a razor-sharp chunk of 25mm frag. James washed the wound before wrapping it with field bandages.
Oh, that stings.
I can cauterize it with a hot iron if you'd prefer.
Smartass.
The other man left in the camp was Sean Collins. A long burst of fire from the chain gun had raked his headquarters, shattering the bamboo and bringing the flimsy building down on top of him. By the time he dug himself out, the fight was over. Not being suicidal, when he heard the commandos order the end of the resistance, he knew it was too late for him to try to run. Instead, he got to his feet and held his hands up as well. As the only white man in the camp, he soon got the attention he feared.
You just keep him up.
Hawkins kept the muzzle of his weapon centered on Collins as he keyed his comlink.
I got him.
Even though these commandos didn't use badges of rank, it was easy enough for Collins to see who was the man in charge. The hard-eyed mercenary wearing the maroon beret who strode forward was obviously their leader. The unwavering muzzle of the HNK subgun in his hand backed up the first impression.
Where's Belasco?
Collins knew an SAS man when he saw one and realized the extreme danger he was in. Whoever this soldier was, he had to know of his IRA background. The provost and the SAS were the most bitter of enemies, and the SAS didn't like to take prisoners. His only chance to stay alive was to tell everything he knew.
My field commander told me that he was killed in a jungle ambush a couple of days ago.
Who's your field commander and where is he?
His name's Ramon Zapatas. I haven't seen him since the attack started.
What's his nationality?
Colombian originally, but he's operated in many countries.
Describe him.
Early 40s, typical Spanish blood. Thin face, dark hair cut short, dark eyes, 5'10", and maybe 12 stone.
I'll check the bodies.
Where was this ambush your man reported?
He didn't show me on the map, and our maps of this region are notoriously inaccurate anyway. So I'm sorry, but I can't help you there. All I know is that supposedly he was shot, fell into a swift-running river, and went over a waterfall. Zapatas was certain that he was dead before he hit the water.
Did your man actually examine the body?
No.
Who was the Arab we found?
Mamal had been dressed more or less the same as all the others in the camp, but he had insisted on wearing a curved dagger and a checkered neck scarf. The knife, the scarf, and his hawk-nosed face had made the ethnic ID of his corpse easy.
His name was Sayed Mamal, of the Islamic Brotherhood.
Nice company you're keeping. Another bunch of bloody murdering bastards.
What happens now?
Well, boyo, you're looking at spending the rest of your life in a small cell. Very small, if I have anything to do with it. You're going to have a long time to think about what a rotten IRA bastard you are. Oh, I almost forgot. We got a call from the Nobel Peace Prize people right before we left to visit you here. They decided that they weren't going to give their prize to a murdering IRA bastard after all. They're going to give it to a syphilitic whore instead.
Collins lunged for a machete someone had dropped a few feet away. Hawkins swung his weapon around.
No, he's mine.
The Briton backed off long enough to lay down his weapon and draw his own machete from his assault harness.
Okay, boyo, let's play.
James had joined Hawkins and with Katz formed a rough circle around the two men. If McCarter wanted to do this, it was okay with them.
SAS bastard!
McCarter sidestepped a slash and riposted with his own blade, slicing a thin cut along Collins's arm. Having once been a proper British soldier, McCarter had been trained in the long blade as well as the short. Collins knew knives, but only to gut some unsuspecting prisoner or to cut a throat. Sword fighting and knife fighting were very different art forms, and what worked with one didn't necessarily work with the other. When McCarter saw how awkward the Irishman was with the machete, he knew he was facing a knife fighter, not a swordsman.
Is that the best you can do, boyo? That's right, I forgot. You're more into killing women and children in front of supermarkets with car bombs, aren't you?
Collins lunged at McCarter as if he were holding a huge knife. The Briton parried easily. The blade had slid past Collins's arm and sunk deep into his belly. Jerking the machete free, McCarter paused a moment before slashing the brush-cutting blade across the man's neck.
I'm not sure the president wanted him killed.
If he doesn't like it, the next time he has a dirty little job he wants done, he can bloody well do it himself, can't he?
There wasn't much Katz could answer to that. Calvin James had just finished checking over Dan Denning when Katz and McCarter joined him.
He's a bit bruised, he needs a bath, some good food, and a week or two of R&R, but he's okay.
I'm okay. I just need to get the hell out of this place.
What can you tell us about Belasco? Do you know why he took off?
I think he escaped to try to take the pressure off me. He urged me to tell that bastard everything I knew, but I just couldn't do it. And when they kept beating me, he took off in the middle of the night without saying anything. Apparently, he grabbed a gun on his way out, because he started ambushing the patrols Collins sent after him. I have to admit, it worked. Once he took off, Collins treated me much differently. I don't know if he wanted to use me as bait to trap Belasco or what, but the beating stopped. Actually, the strange thing was that Collins also quit asking me about the DEA operations and started asking me about Belasco.
What do you mean?
He wanted to know what I knew of his background and what agency he worked for, that sort of thing. It was like he was trying to build a dossier on him.
Katz wasn't surprised to hear that. It fit right in with what Trent Carlsworth had tried to do from Washington.
About him being hunted in the woods, Collins told us that his field commander reported that he had tracked down Belasco and killed him. Do you know anything about that?
Sabatas told me the same thing, too. In fact, he bragged to me about it. But he didn't come back with a body, so I don't know what to think.
We're going out there to look for him. And if you feel you're up to it, I'd like you to stay here with our pilot and keep an eye on this mob. His chain gun can cover only so much.
Be glad to.
McCarter waited until the DEA man had walked off before speaking to Katz.
What do you think?
You and I have been at this game far too long to think that anyone is bulletproof. But both of us have seen him get out of worse situations than this. As soon as we get this mess sorted out, we're going out there to find him.
The SATCOM link's up and hot. What do you want me to tell Hal?
Give him a report of the assault and tell him that Collins is dead. On Stryker, simply tell him that he's still in the jungle and that we're going out after him as soon as we have this secured.
Katz felt there was no sense in putting the farm crew through another grieving session until either Bolin or his body was found. If he was found dead, there would be time enough to mourn him then.
Better yet, let me talk to him.
Katz says that they don't have a firm lead on him yet, but they have recent spottings of him. Now that they've taken care of Collins' operation, they'll be able to concentrate on finding where he's hiding out.
Even though she was more personally involved in finding Bolin than she usually was in a Stony Man mission, Price wasn't about to allow her personal feelings get in the way of doing what had to be done.
Is there anything we can do to help from here?
I'm afraid not, but I told him to get in touch with us the minute we can do something.
Hal Brognola's report to the president on the Red Secure phone was well guarded, and he didn't voice his concerns about Mac Boland's survival. Now that Sean Collins had been taken out, the president was focused completely on the second phase of the operation, which was putting the nation of Peru back together again under a stable government. The president's plan for the takedown of the coalition handed the issue back to the Peruvians themselves, but it was Peru's Vice President Castillo, instead of President Oswaldo Simón, who would be in charge of that operation. President Simón was going to fall with the coalition he had so strongly promoted. He would be allowed to resign and even to keep his government pension. Vice President Castillo would succeed him, and he promised to hold new elections in 3 months. The odds were that Castillo would win the election in a landslide. He had done a good job as the nation's number two and was well-liked throughout the country. So while the U.S. president was so deeply involved with the fate of a brother politician, his mind wasn't on the fate of one of his operatives. Brognola knew that the president would remember Bolin and ask about him in a few days. And by that time, hopefully, the executioner's fate would also be known. As soon as the jungle camp had been secured and everyone disarmed, Gary Manning, Calvin James, and TJ Hawkins quickly rigged enough trees in the middle of the camp with demolition charges to blow out a landing zone for the Blackhawk. A few wraps of detcord and a handful of C4 in the right place could topple even the tallest tree. As each tree came down, the unarmed Indians dragged it out of the way. As soon as the trees were cleared, Jack Grimaldi brought his helicopter to a hover directly over the hole that had been created in the jungle and slowly lowered the ship through it.
What's the drill? We're going to look for Stryker. If he's out there, we're going to find him. What about me? Gadgets and the DEA man are going to stay here with you and keep an eye on things until these people disperse. I'm going to have their weapons loaded on board, and I want you to jettison them from 10,000 feet the next time you're over a mountain.
With the Blackhawk serving as a mobile command post, McCarter and Katz quickly worked up a plan. With so much ground to cover, the only thing they could plan was to stay in the jungle until they had covered every inch of it.
Okay. Carl, I'd like you and Paul to link up with TJ and Rafe to form one search team. Katz and I will go out with Gary and Calvin. Unless anyone has a better idea, we'll start doing clover leaves, using this camp as our starting point. Gadgets can run the comm center from the chopper, and Jack can airdrop us supplies as we need them and stay close for the extraction. We may bump into remnants of Collins' Indian fighters. If we do, we'll offer them a break. If they want to walk away, we'll let them go. If they want to fight, we'll do that too. But we're not going to let anyone get in our way.
We need to get an ammo resupply before we go, then. We kind of burned through our basic load this morning.
It's in the chopper.
Ramon Sabatis and the two Indians were moving out at a good pace, but they weren't running. They had a long way to go. 2 miles away from the camp, Sabatis got a feeling that someone was watching him. He hadn't seen or heard anything, but his instincts were screaming at him. The battle-tested mercenary hadn't survived as long as he had by not trusting his instincts, and he trusted them again this time. He instantly signaled a halt and dropped into cover. Now that the sounds of combat behind him had ended, he knew that Collins's camp had been neutralized. Sabatis knew how to become one with his surroundings as well as any of the other denizens of the jungle. Slitting his eyes, he let his gaze travel over the jungle in front of him, searching alternately high and low. He could neither hear, smell, nor see anything alarming. The sounds were those he knew were normal for that time of day. And they weren't muted, as they would be if men were hiding in ambush somewhere nearby. His mind, though, continued to warn him of danger. Sabatis didn't particularly mind dying. The life of a soldier of fortune forced a man to confront his mortality. He wasn't, however, going to go down without a fight. Whoever was out there wasn't going to take him while he was on his knees praying. He was stronger than that. When he signaled to move out, he saw that only one of his Indian trackers was still with him. Miguel, the younger one, had deserted him, and only Juan had stayed at his side. That angered him, but he would take care of that later. The jungle wasn't big enough to hide a man who had crossed him. Bolin was motionless. The poison in his system still affected his mind, and his eyes still showed him the extra vivid, glowing vision of the jungle instead of what he would usually see. He sensed that this enemy, whoever he was moving toward him. This man was evil. Many of his kind were in the jungle today, but this one differed from the rest because he didn't have an edge of fear about him. Where the others were fleeing for their lives, this man wasn't. He was simply changing his territory. Silently, Bolin rose from his perch and descended to the jungle floor. The evil one was coming closer, and he had to be killed, or he would make a wasteland of wherever he went next. Bolin watched as a man came into his field of view, and he drew his knife. His unshaven face and dried mud on his tattered clothing were effective camouflage, but it was the stillness that came over him that made him one with his surroundings. He slitted his eyes and kept his mouth closed so as not to give his position away. When the enemy passed within a yard of his position, Bolin sprang.
What?
Sabatis couldn't believe his eyes. He had killed Belasco and had seen him fall into the river. Before he could bring his AK to bear, Bolin's left hand clamped around the barrel of the rifle. The Colombian tried to free his weapon, but it was held in an iron grip. Focused on that tug of war, he didn't see what was in Bolin's right hand. The Phoenix Force warriors stayed together after leaving the camp until they were 1,000 yards into the jungle. Then they split into their 2 search parties and went their separate ways. They would search out for 5 miles, then come back in toward the camp and continue that search pattern until they found him. An hour later, the trail McCarter's group followed was empty 1 minute, and the next, Mac Bolin stood in their path as if he had materialized out of thin air. On point, James drew down on the figure. As his finger tightened on the trigger, his eyes registered who it was he was about to kill.
Stryker!
Bolin stood with his hands held open at his sides as James walked up to him.
Jesus, where you been?
The rest of the search team hurried to Boland's side as Katz and Ellenbogen stepped up to him.
Look at his eyes. I think he's been drugged.
I've got Jack on the way.
I know you. You have a strong heart.
We'll get you back, Stryker.
Without waiting to be told, Manning fired up the SATCOM radio and put a call through to Stony Man Farm.
Brugnola.
We have him. He's alive.
Hand me that thing. Like Gary said, he's alive, but we need a specialized medical team down here immediately.
How bad is he?
Except for being filthy from being in the woods, he looks okay physically. Calvin is checking him over now, but I think he's either been poisoned or drugged. I think he knows us, but it's like he's caught up in some kind of bad trip and is hallucinating.
I'll get a team of CDC toxicologists and a mercy flight on the way from Elgin ASAP.
Tell them to be prepared for any kind of toxin. Whatever's wrong with him, it's major.
I'll get them on the way as quickly as I can.
Until they get here, I'm going to have Jack fly him to our country safe house. Calvin and the embassy doctor can care for him there until you can get that team down here. I don't want to take him into Lima because we wouldn't be able to adequately secure him. The only place we could take him would be the embassy, and we know it's been compromised.
Do what you have to do, but get him out of the jungle.
Extraction is on the way.
Boland wanted to stay in the jungle. Life was simple there. Hunt, eat, drink, sleep, and repel all intruders. It was a good life, but one that deep in his mind he knew wasn't his. His life was with these men, and the longer he was with them, the more he knew that was true. Even glimpses of their names were surfacing in his mind, as were snatches of the times they had spent together. He belonged with these men, and would go willingly with them. Boland watched the helicopter draw closer through the breaks in the tops of the trees. In the depths of his mind, he knew that he was familiar with these things, and that they weren't to be feared. The Black Hawk went into a low hover to lower the SAR jungle penetrator, and he knew what it was doing. When the basket reached the ground, he automatically stepped into it and buckled the safety straps. Calvin James stepped into the basket with him, and they were lifted into the air. Inside the chopper, he again automatically went to one of the canvas troop seats next to a window, sat down, and strapped himself in. Turning his head to look back, he felt a pang of regret as the chopper lifted off.
Stony Man Conflict Imperative is a Graphic Audio production. Stony Man, The Executioner, and Mac Bolan are trademarks owned by Harlequin Enterprises Limited, used by others under license. Copyright 2000, Worldwide Library, all rights reserved. Production copyright 2007, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Performed by James Konacek, Terence Aselford, Nanette Savard, Thomas Penny, Christopher Graybill, David Coyne, Richard Rowan, James Lewis, Ken Jackson, Dylan Lynch, Jeff Baker, Sonny Lasky, Michael Replogle, Kate Torrey, Karen Carbone, and Mort Shelby. Additional red shirts by The Dead Giveaways. Adapted for Graphic Audio by Casey Jones. Dialogue editing by Nathaniel Perry. Graphic Audio sound design by Nathaniel Perry and Temeskin Wubna. Directed by Dan Smith. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. The Stony Man theme was composed by Mark Ashby. Additional original music by Nathaniel Perry, Chris Rowan, Dan Smith, and Johann Detweiler. If you enjoyed Stony Man, be sure to look for Don Pendleton's Mac Boland and Ryder Stacy's Doomsday Warrior. Available at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloadable extras, forums, and podcasts. Keep listening for a preview of another Graphic Audio title.
Eagles 12, Crusade of Eagles. The McAllister clan was raised on a harsh, unforgiving frontier, where courage and blood bonds mattered the most. While Falcon McAllister followed his father's mountain man legacy, his brother and sister made their fame and fortune on the stages of New York and Europe. Now, they're planning a family reunion. Andrew and Rosanna McAllister are headed to Colorado visit their kin until they step into the crosshairs of a murderer's plan.
I'm going to count to five. If I don't find out which ones of you are the McAllisters by the time I get to five, I'm going to kill this woman. Then I'm going to start counting to five again and kill someone else. And then I'll keep on killing until I find what I'm looking for. One.
You're mad. You wouldn't do that.
Two.
You'll never get away with it.
Three.
No, please.
Four.
I'm Andrew McAllister.
I thought this would bring you out.
Lowering the hammer on his pistol, Loomis signaled for the others to move toward Andrew.
What do you want with me?
Where's your sister?
You've got me. That's enough. You can't have my sister, too.
That's all right. If you really feel that way, I'll just start killing all the women here till I get the right one.
I'm the one you seek.
You're the one I seek? God damn, you folks do talk fancy, don't you? You got any clothes with you?
They're in the baggage car.
Then put on what you was wearing before you climbed into the bed last night. I don't care what you wear, just get dressed, the both of you.
What do you want us to get dressed for?
Because you're coming with us.
What makes you think we're going to come with you?
You want anyone else to die? No. Then both of you get dressed. Pronto.
Loomis Tate knows that the two actors from back east have a rich brother named Falcon. But he's not counting on how fiercely that brother would fight for his kin after Tate's crew, including the venomous albino, kidnapped him for ransom.
It's McAllister!
Falcon McAllister is on a crusade, and his war won't be over until the last bad man drops. Don't miss Crusade of Eagles.
Dear Anya, I found this journal. It contains the story of an Austrian baron, Frederick of Schluter, who heard the tale of a Viking who lived among the Curonians. This Viking was named Thor, and he had an enchanted hammer that gave him power to crush all his enemies. One of the stories told of fabulous treasure that Thor brought with him from his homeland. It's there, Anya. And I think I've almost found it.
Vorfun has gone to Riga in an effort to track down the fortune. But there have been problems.
What kind of problems?
There is a woman who is believed descended from the Curonians. She's supposed to be a witch.
What's her interest?
We think she's seeking the treasure as well. She had taken up with an Italian archaeologist named Mario Fellini. Wolfram arranged to have the man killed, but not before he involved another archaeologist. He sent her a package, but we don't know what the contents were. That woman has proved even more irksome, and it appears now she's hunting the treasure as well.
Who is she?
Her name is Anya Creed.
Archaeologist Anya Creed is drawn into a deadly game of cat and mouse with ruthless international killers intent on finding centuries-old treasure. To survive and prevail, she must depend on the help of old friends. 500-year-old friends, to be exact.
Irvin, shoot her!
This is like ultimate fighting!
Here, Anya!
Thanks for coming.
You're welcome.
There is Anya Creed. We know she's out there stealing our treasure.
I'm not going to tell you.
Oh! Where is she?
Oh. Do you have a map?
But will one of her friends come to a tragic end?
Karin!
Rogue Angel 7, God of Thunder.
No one harms my family.
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net.